Coming to you from Orange County, California, this is the Jug Life Podcast with Max Ada and Chad Wesley Smith.
Hey everybody, Chad Wesley Smith here, bringing you another episode of the Jug Life Podcast. Joined as always, Montana Miracle Man, Max Ada. How you doing, buddy?
Doing pretty well. How are you doing, Chad?
Pretty good. Hopefully I'm saying the same in an hour. So today we're going to be probably talking about one of our most serious topics, our most sensitive subjects, certainly we've ever addressed on this show, and that is the concept of transgender athletes, of gender testing in sport, and it's becoming a more prevalent issue, something more at the forefront of athletics every day, and something that, you know, we wanted to address because it had a pretty direct effect on Max's wife, Joanne Ada, at the recent World Games for weightlifting. So could you talk about
the situation there? There was, in the Masters World Games, we had one competitor I know of, Laurel Hubbard is transgendered and competed in the super heavyweight category in the female division. And won. I think made like a personal record snatch, 131 kilos, and then maybe clean and jerk to like 149, I think. Obviously one grandmaster beat the field by a huge margin.
And Joanne was the runner-up for Grandmaster.
Yeah, Joanne was second place overall that.
Grandmaster is a comparison by Malone Metzer.
Yeah.
So an age-adjusted Sinclair formula. So Joanne would have been the best female lifter of the entire competition had it not been for Laurel Hubbard.
Yeah. There's also, that's not the first. There's obviously been a lot of stuff. Not a lot, but there's been cases of this happening, this particular thing happening, but of transgendered competitors in other sports, too. You've got a few years ago, there was Caster Semenya.
Well, before we get into that, I think let's make a disclaimer here. We're probably going to have to make many disclaimers throughout this episode that, you know, Max and I are not experts in this. We're not professing to be experts in this. We're going to share the limited amount of research we've done on the rules and effects of gene therapy and all this stuff, and then things that are our opinions. You know, we're not setting out to offend people in this. More likely than not, we'll probably say something wrong. Yeah, we're going to call something wrong name, wrong term. We don't know everything that's the right stuff to say. So please understand that when we're going
bear with us here for a second.
So the first important distinction I think to make as we get into this is that Laurel Hubbard was born and lived as a man for the overwhelming majority of her life. Other athletes we're going to talk about, and probably even a bit more of what we're going to talk about, are female athletes who on their birth certificate it says female. They've lived their entire lives as women, and then at some point during their athletic career, when they were more likely than not very, very good, the competitors and people around the sport said, "What's going on here? This is not a woman," and then applying some level of gender testing. So that's going to be a very important distinction to make between Laurel Hubbard, born as a man, competing as a woman, and Caster Semenya, who we'll talk about more, Maria Martinez Patino, who we'll talk about more, born as women, and then gender testing issues in their career.
And I think, the major thing is that all of the stuff that comes out, the stories and whatnot, I think maybe clump everybody together into the same categories. Like, oh, there's this sort of gender identity stuff, that's this whole category. There's a lot of different things, like Chad was saying, there's a lot of different things actually going on with very specific circumstances around each individual athlete's scenario. you know, it's obviously like you just said, Laura Hubbard was transitioning or transitioned from male to female. And then you have other situations that are maybe very different where an athlete is maybe even unaware of, you know, pre-existing situations that are not as obvious or not as conscious, right?
Yeah. So let's establish kind of the rules. Again, this is from a limited amount of research, so there may be updates to these rules since, you know, from where I read about them last night. But to our understanding, for the NCAA rule is that a transgender athlete, and just for the ease of this, we're probably going to use that as a bit of a blanket term, understanding that it's going to encompass a lot of nuance within that, has to sit out from competition for 1 year while undergoing hormone therapy. And then the IOC rule, so to compete as an Olympic athlete or in sports that are governed by, you know, Olympic-sanctioned bodies, like World Master Games for weightlifting, was that there must be 2 years of hormone therapy post-operation, for like a post-gender reassignment surgery. Again, the terms. I might be saying the wrong word. I'm gonna stop apologizing it for the rest of the time. Blanket apology for all the times that I mess up some of the terms here. And within that IOC rule, there at least was an establishment of a limit of testosterone of 10 nanomoles per liter of testosterone. One of the cases that we're going to talk about a little bit more involving an Indian sprinter named Duti Chand, looks like it's suspended for the ruling in that by the Court of Arbitration and Sport suspended that limit. So in these situations, there is not a limit to how much testosterone female competitors could have. Now, where this gets a little bit cloudier too, and where I don't have a complete understanding of it, is how things are differentiated between no limit on testosterone and drug testing.
Yeah, that's really interesting to me, because there's motives for everything. I mean, you have to assume that every very competitive athlete has at some point had a motive. I mean, the motive to cheat is obvious, right? To win. So when you're in a situation where your personal life outside of sport involves whatever it involves in terms of, you know, what you believe should or shouldn't be, you know, in your life in terms of gender, et cetera, how that, you know, I don't, it would be very unlikely, I think, to the stretch that somebody would reassign their gender or change gender to gain an edge in performance, because, you know, I suppose the recognition you gain from winning would also be, you know, quote unquote, tainted by the incredible amount of stress that you have to go through in life. Just going through that process has got to be not an easy thing. You know, whereas if you're just somebody who, you know, cheats and takes drugs to win, that is what it is, and that's not, you know.
Very much a win at all costs scenario.
Yeah, that would be extreme.
Anything that it takes. So a little bit more about the IOC rule there. To my understanding, from what I've read, in 2015 through this case of Duti Chand versus the Athletics Federation of India and the ruling through the Court of Arbitration for Sport, the 10 nanomoles per liter of testosterone limit for women currently does not exist. That was the case in 2015, and they told the IAAF, the International Athletics Federation, the world governing body for track and field, that they had 2 years to prove that putting a limit on it is important, that essentially that testosterone is significant to female athletic performance. From where I'm sitting, that sounds like a no-brainer.
Yeah.
But it is clearly significant. But just as a reference point, that at least used to be 10 nanomoles per liter of testosterone was established as some limit. Potentially next month will be the two-year mark from that case when the IAAF needs to reprove that 10 nanomoles per liter is a good number, where the normal range for women is 0.5 to 3 nanomoles per liter, and the range for men is 10 to 30. So they're basically saying that the cutoff is the bottom end range for men.
Right. That is very high.
Yeah. So that brings us to this idea for athletes like Dudi Chand, who is the Indian national champion in the 100 meter, and I think only one of two or three women to ever represent India in the Olympics in that event. Athletes like Caster Semenya, who Max had mentioned, who's a world and Olympic champion in the 800 meters. An athlete we'll talk about a bit more named Maria Martinez Patino, a hurdler from Spain, who was kind of one of the first people to have failed a gender test, and it become a big issue. All of those athletes different than Laurel Hubbard in that they have something called the SRY gene. And what that creates is androgen insensitivity syndrome. So to my understanding, this is a crossing over of genes on the chromosomes, which results in the athlete having hidden testes with suppressed androgen receptors. So what we're getting to with that is an athlete who has a vagina with internal testicles and no uterus. I feel like I'm in eighth grade health class right now.
I mean, hidden testes just sounds like a game that your creepy uncle's trying to play with you. That's a definite no-no. Continue.
Yeah. So with the presence of this SRY gene, you get, and with the suppressed androgen receptors of it, the androgen insensitivity syndrome component of this, you get athletes who were born as females, who their entire life have lived as females, who it says female on their birth certificate, but they're producing male amounts of testosterone, but because of the suppressed receptors, are not able to really take advantage of that. So
it's an interesting scenario. Did you read, or is there any information as to whether or not you can have the SRY gene, but also have hidden testes? In which case, you would receive the more benefit from the testosterone. Obviously, you might not know that.
Yeah, that would be what I guess. Across.
Okay, maybe it goes hand in hand. Maybe that's the same scenario, right?
To my understanding, I'd say yes. That's what it happened. So, with that kind of the resulting thing is you get a very genetically advantaged female athlete.
Right.
You get them with much more male-esque characteristics, minus, you know, the parts.
And some of the parts, one of the parts.
Yeah, at least visible parts. And up to, we're going to talk some about gender testing, because up until the Mexico City Olympics in 1968, the gender testing process, you know, had existed in the Olympics, had existed in international sports like track and field and stuff, and that test was pull down your pants, let's see what you got.
The ocular pat down.
Yes, an ocular pat down. And that, not surprisingly, seemed to be insensitive and invasive to athletes, embarrassing, all kinds of different things. Mm-hmm. So in 1968, and this practice continued from 68 all the way through the Atlanta Olympics in 1996, they began doing these cheek swabs and testing the chromosomes within the cheek swab. And where that became more confusing, more debatable, these gray areas, was within these hyper androgynous athletes, or athletes with hyperandrogenism and the SRY gene, that they're looking at people and by their bone structure and their muscularity and all these different factors, someone like Caster Semenya probably looking at them thinking, that is a man. But the genetic testing was showing otherwise, and that's where these debates arise from.
Right.
So,
Caster Semenya was subject to the swab test, right?
Yes.
Okay.
So when Caster Semenya is a 800-meter runner, a long-distance runner for middle-distance runner, I guess, for South Africa, and she came along in 2009, and really no one had ever heard of her, and in the span of about 6 months, I want to say it took something like 8 or 9 seconds off of her PR in the 800, a race where women are running, Olympic-level women are running right about the two-minute mark, a little bit underneath that to make the finals. And at 2009 World Championships, came and ran like 156, 157, and won by 2, 3, 4 seconds. And people are like, we've never heard of this person. Yeah. Like, something's going on here, whether it's steroid use or whether it's transgender issues and whatever, something's going on here, test her. And they did that, and there was a lot of issues about the privacy of the testing and what her rights as a athlete and person were, and if that kind of stuff was being violated. But at the end of that process in 2010, they said, yes, she is a woman, she gets to compete as a woman, you keep your medal from the World Championships, and she's gone to be very, very successful Olympic champion, I believe, after that as well. I remember in that 2009 race and in lots of international competition in the 800-meter, I have a friend who we're in the same recruiting class at Cal, and a girl named Alicia Johnson, now Alicia Montaño, who, if you watch Olympic track and field, you may know her as the flying flower, runs with the big like yellow flower in her hair. I think Alicia is like 7 or 8-time national champion in the U.S., U.S. national champion in the 800. Phenomenal athlete. I've talked about her on a previous episode in regards to retroactive drug testing, how she took 5th in the 2012 Olympics, and that two of the athletes above her ended up failing retroactive tests, and she lost out on 4 years of being bronze medalist. Alicia Johnson, instead of being 5th place, Alicia Johnson, and the monetary gain and everything that goes along with that. Well, I've also seen her deal with racing against Caster Semenya, and I remember seeing that race in 2009 that Alicia was in, and I think got 5th at Worlds, thinking like, this is bullshit. Yeah. This is a different playing field. But Caster Semenya has this SRY gene, androgen insensitivity. Her entire life has lived as a woman, says female on the birth certificate, but has internal testes, suppressed androgen receptors. But with that, a lot of the other performance benefits to some degree that performance differences to some degree that come along with being a man, such as taller, she's like 5'10", 160, generally heavier, bigger heart, bigger lungs,
right,
less body fat, denser bones, more red blood cells, narrower hips, which is a big one for sprinting performance, relatively greater upper body strength. So with that, Caster Semenya created a lot of controversy, a lot of discussion about this topic. The other athlete I mentioned, Duty Chand from India, she was breaking all these Indian national records, and then they came along and said, all right, we're doing gender tests, and then they said she had too much testosterone, even though in the same situation, born as a woman, lived her whole life as a woman. And, that's current, still, I guess, kind of undergoing arbitration, at least the part of how much testosterone should women really have. So it all goes to beg the question, in the case of athletes with the SRY gene, is how much does testosterone help? What is the difference between performing as a man and performing as a woman? There was a paper written in 1992 by some physiologists at UCLA, published in the Journal of Nature. The title of the paper is, "Will Women Soon Outrun Men?" And in this, I don't see how these guys ever came to this conclusion, but in it, through graphing the progress of men's and women's world records across like all track and field events, they projected that women would beat men in track and field events by the year 2156. And they were saying this because the progress in women's in the women's world records was much more rapid. And that was happening for a number of reasons. It was happening because women hadn't been in the sport as long. There was even times up in like the 30s, maybe even until the 50s, where women were not allowed to do certain events.
Right.
They felt that, that the longer running events were too strenuous to for women's bodies to do. So they just had a shorter you know, lifespan of these women's events, which of course is going to yield greater improvement. And then there was this other thing that happened. It was called steroids.
So it happened.
Yeah. So it's the men had been using that for a longer period of time since the late 50s, where for women, that was probably coming on a little bit later as women's sports became more and more competitive, that got introduced to things. Good example of how that's going to accelerate performance and concentrate performance and skew this kind of experiment that these guys were doing. In the women's shot put, of the top 80 performances of all time, 75 of them happened between 1975 and 1990. And a time that, you know, sports historians such as ourselves understand is a time it was a free-for-all.
Yeah.
You know, it was a free-for-all of drug use.
It's like hometown buffet, but with D-ball and all sorts of other good stuff.
From the Soviet Union, East Germany, and let's not be naive and exempt American women from this either. It was a smorgasbord of stenazinol. So, of course, it had this highly accelerated performance. And the reason that performance was being accelerated, I think, gets right to the heart of this issue. It's how is the Court of Arbitration of Sport saying to the IAAF, "Well, prove to us that testosterone helps." Well, then yeah, why the fuck is there drug testing if you guys are in question?
I find that really interesting that they have to even state that, that they can even state that in that. I guess they're trying to say prove that it actually makes a difference for women, but they already have rules in place that would preclude some, that would prevent somebody from taking the drugs. Yeah. If there were just any female competitor taking testosterone is against the rules. Now they're asking to prove that it's actually, what if the case was made that it does not improve performance,
or yeah, happens to drug testing?
They can prove it, then how could they ever suspend anybody for taking testosterone?
Yeah, and maybe this is a lack of understanding on our part in terms of, or maybe you understand it, the answer here, is a lot of about, you know, testing for testosterone is the ratio. 6 to 1.
4 to 1.
Is it 4 to 1 now?
I think it's 4 to 1 weightlifting.
It definitely used to be 6 to 1 for track.
Yeah, you know? It may have even been higher in the past.
It was 10 to 1 for cycling.
Yeah.
Which seems very odd to me that, like, oh yeah, these cyclists might just have super high testosterone.
Yeah, very odd.
But does it matter? Is the ratio affected by the nanomoles per liter of testosterone, or is this like a total testosterone number? Because a six to one ratio could be 6 to 1, or it could be 1,000 or 6,000 to 1,000.
Yeah. So I actually, and I may be mistaken, and it'd be correct me if I'm wrong. I believe they used to start the testing procedure first by doing a ratio test. Mm-hmm. If you failed the ratio test, then they would do a further test to see the absolute value of testosterone, of free testosterone, or whatever they're testing. So if you didn't fail the ratio test, they wouldn't even do the second test. And I believe what people were doing was titrating testosterone with estrogen right up next to the meat so that the ratio test wouldn't set off a red flag.
Well, and that's a lot of what, like, Balco and the Clear and the Cream was about.
Right.
It was about keeping the, you know, raising the free testosterone compared to DHT or whatever whatever it is. I actually don't know what the ratio is of.
I think it's epitestosterone.
Oh, yeah.
Right?
Okay.
So
they were just taking both testosterone and epitestosterone.
So your total value comes up, which is going to be performance enhancing, but it doesn't set off the red flag of a ratio that's off. And I believe now the current procedure is to test the total free testosterone, the total value, which makes more sense anyways, because if you find right off the bat it's high, they're just out.
Who is the MMA guy, Alistair Overeem?
Alistair Overeem.
Yeah, like 53-1.
I got a great story about Alistair Overeem.
And he tried to claim that it was natural.
Yeah, he tried to claim it was natural. So we're in the hospital in Thailand. We went to Thailand, and we're there. And, my son hurt his foot, and so we go to the hospital. And I'm standing in the hospital in Thailand. And I'm looking, and it's like this kind of really big open atrium. And there's like these glass doors, and I see this dude, and I just recognize him. I'm like, I know this guy, I think. I'm pretty sure I know who this guy is. And he sees me, and he makes eye contact, and he knows, and he has a look on his face like, he knows I know who he is, but I don't know who he is yet. Mm-hmm. And we're looking at each other for a second, and then he kind of just goes away, turns away, and 5 minutes later he comes out of the room with his girlfriend, who was a very attractive young lady, and I see him, I'm like, looking at him, and he's looking at me, like, again, the same look, and then I realize, I'll start over him. And he was just hanging out there, probably.
And he's like, they're
probably getting his testosterone naturally checked.
He's like, dangerous. Oh my God, it's Rudy Nielsen.
And then he said, hey, Rudy Nielsen.
Holy shit, it's Seth Rogen.
Yeah, he thought I was somebody else.
So there's the ratio stuff, and I'm not 100% sure how this nanomoles per liter of testosterone is related to the ratio and, you know, the difference of testing for synthetic testosterone versus natural testosterone. And how all that works, but it sounds a bit fishy. And this idea that and to read from whatever article took this from, I can't remember the Chand ruling. So this is the Court of Arbitration of Sport ruling in favor of sprinter Dutee Chand of India, who had been barred from competition in 2014 due to testosterone levels above established limits. Chand ruling provisionally cleared the way for intersex athletes to compete without testosterone parameters. The IAAF has 2 years to show why the limit should be restored. Meanwhile, Caster Semenya, during the same time, running during a period of no rules limitations, is unbeaten in 9 800-meter finals, and at a meet in South Africa in the spring, she won the 400, 800, and 1500 in times each of which would have been competitive at the world level. If Semenya was indeed suddenly freed from drugs to suppress her testosterone, the effect on her sport was even more dramatic than on her times. So that's the other part, is these hypoandrogynous athletes with the SRY gene, some of them are having to take testosterone-suppressing drugs, similarly to what a transgender athlete like Laurel Hubbard, transitioning from male to female, would need to do to make sure that their levels are under, or at least were having to do this to make sure their levels were under the 10 nanomoles per liter.
Mm-hmm.
So to get back to the – sorry, what were you going to say?
Basically you have unrestricted – I mean, to have no actual limit on that is just obscene.
Yeah, that does
– like, for, it's just bizarre, too. From any perspective, it's like – there has to be some kind of boundary there, right? I mean, whether the boundary is even – the fact that it doesn't even exist is just bizarre. I mean, why wouldn't you just have some kind of finite number that you can assign to it? Even if that's ridiculous, it's still
– particularly because with this limit currently not existing, the idea of 2 years of hormone therapy post-op for – to be able to compete in the IOC for someone like Laurel Hubbard – it's just so vague.
So
if the level is 30, okay, she gets hormone therapy to bring it to 25.
Right.
You know, and is or nearly unaffected.
Yeah.
So, you know, we had this paper projecting, you know, will women soon outrun men? That was clearly a very erroneous projection by them because, well, one, it sounded like they'd never actually watched any of these sports. Like, that just ain't how it works. But in their research, they completely negated the idea of female athletes using performance-enhancing drugs.
Right.
Basically all of which are testosterone derivatives.
Right.
So this idea that the IAAF has to prove that testosterone is useful to females is asinine to me.
Yeah.
Looking at some other differences in performance from men's world records to women's world records, in the 100 meters, 10% difference. In the marathon, 10% difference. In the long jump, 19% difference. 50-meter freestyle swimming, 13% difference. Speed skating, 1,000 meters, 9% difference. Weightlifting, and this was just one weight class comparison. I think the 69s to 69s, 25% difference. So in the sport there, that's probably most pertinent to what we're talking about, a 25% advantage for men's lifters compared to women's lifters. Yes, that is... You know, the biggest contributing factor to that is probably testosterone, but also significant contributing factors are going to be the things we mentioned before. Less body fat, denser bones, hip structure, the natural upper body strength, and the study, and I'll try and post in the comments of this stuff, like these different articles that I was getting these from, but upper body strength differences was 3 standard deviations of men, you know, any man off the street compared to any woman off the street, upper body strength comparison, meaning 997 out of 1,000 men were likely to have greater upper body strength than the female. So some of those are related to testosterone, but some of them are related to bone structure and all that kind of stuff. Things that don't change with hormone therapy.
Yeah. Yeah, that, I mean, I guess you could look at it and say, assuming you had a female who was taking testosterone for 25 years, then cessation of testosterone for 2 years, I mean, the effect has to be, I mean, there's got to be some significant performance benefit to doing that because, yeah. I mean, 25 years of augmentation followed by a small time of not, just as you would if you were a male for 25 years, then you're not, and you're competing against people that had nowhere close to that level of testosterone in their body ever.
Yeah, so a couple other notes before we kind of get into the bigger discussion of all this. Just to frame what we're talking about in regards to performance differences between men and women. We have an athlete named Joanna Harper. And if you haven't read the book or listened to the audiobook version of it, in my case, The Sports Gene, whose the author's name is escaping me for a second here, but the David Epstein, The Sports Gene by David Epstein, he has a chapter in there called Why Men Have Nipples, and it talks about a lot of these genetic differences. And in it, he talks about an athlete named Joanna Harper, who is Masters National Champion in cross country in 2009. And Joanna Harper had transitioned from male to female in 2004. So 2004 is our line of demarcation. In 2005, she ran about 50 seconds slower per mile than she had in 2003. So that's a significant difference. That's a big difference, having gone through the hormone therapy, gender reassignment surgery, and hormone therapy, to lose 50 seconds per mile in a run. But as far as sex and age-graded performance, showed about the same level of competitiveness for either one. So in that sport, cross-country, maybe is you know, it's going to be probably different based on these different sports, more explosive sports to more endurance-based sports. Laurel Hubbard, master, grandmaster from Masters World Games recently in New Zealand, snatched 6 kilos more competing as a woman than she ever did competing as a man. And now, these are N1 examples. You know, this is not formalized study. There's time and training that went on there. She could have been doing shit, you know, program as a man and a great one as a woman. But all things considered there, 6 kilos more.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I guess that's really, that's actually a very intriguing scenario in that you would assume if Harper is running 50 seconds less, where running would seem like it'd be even less affected than weightlifting. Mm-hmm. It's pure power-based sport, but still improving. I mean, from a lot of perspectives, it's just very interesting. I mean, that's impressive that there's progress still. Again, you know, training program can have a huge impact on that, you know, and all host of psychological factors, too. If you just feel more comfortable as a person, you might do better in training and, you know, yada, yada, yada. But, yeah, very interesting.
So what all of this kind of comes down to is a discussion of fairness, of what is fair, and, you know, how should these athletes be treated, where should they compete, who should they compete against. And I think it's too clear, or it has to be differentiated between Laurel Hubbard, lived as a man, transitioned to compete as a female, versus Caster Semenya, born as a woman, lived as a woman with this condition that was, and until someone does a gender test on you, you probably have no idea about.
Those testes were hidden the whole time.
Yeah. So to me, to set the marker at 2 years of hormone therapy, particularly with this lack of clear line of this much testosterone is allowed, 2 years I don't think could possibly be significant enough.
Yeah.
I don't know what the number is, but
yeah,
more than 2 years is what I think it is.
Yeah. Well, I mean, to the bigger picture too, the bigger sort of discussion is, I mean, the rules are the rules. So the issue is never with, none of the issues are ever with the competitors, because they're simply playing by the rules as they see them, as the rules exist. So all of these scenarios, anything we're saying in terms of making things more fair, et cetera, is always a matter of pointing out where the rules and the actual decisions to say, hey, this is the limit, that's the time frame, et cetera, that stuff's all based within the rules of the sport. It's certainly an interesting, it's an interesting scenario in that no one's really created a position or created any kind of situation to say, hey, like, we can say that 2 years or 6 months or 18 months is the right time frame because of this. It almost appears to be just completely arbitrary.
Yes.
Just pick a number out of your ass, and there you go. It's
one more real important stat that I forgot to bring up and will be useful here is, during this time of doing the cheek swabs as the gender identification test for the Olympics, from 1968 to 1996, they found on average 1 in 420 women, specifically at the 96 Olympics, it was 1 out of 480, but over the whole time span, almost 30 years, which is significant, body of evidence there, 1 in 480 women competing in the Olympics across all sports had SRY gene, androgen insensitivity. A typical rate of that in the female population is somewhere between 1 in 20,000 and 1 in 64,000. So 500 to 1,500 times more likely.
Yeah.
To exist in a female Olympian than in the general population. So
that's good talent identification.
Yeah. and that kind of seems like it is the thing with the SRY gene, is with that you're really just getting a female who has great genetics for their sport, which is a big difference than getting a male who transitions to a female.
Right.
So to me, there has to be some kind of distinction drawn here. One, there should definitely be a testosterone limit. Right. The fact that there's any debate about is testosterone helpful to female athletes is ridiculous. Of course, it's helpful. If they decide that it's not helpful, then everyone
just start taking it.
Yeah, it gets as much as they want. Like then they would. I don't see how they could argue to not let female athletes who are not transgender or do not have SRY gene, how they could stop them from taking testosterone up to that limit. Like that's ridiculous.
You could almost even say, here's the data we've collected of all the data we can find on testosterone levels in blood for female competitors, female people. And from that pool of data, you say, okay, the average level on the high side, on the low side, this is the average, right? It's not, 400 nanograms per deciliter. It's like 10, right? So that could be the start of that discussion as to where the limit is, right? It's based off of evidence we have for people, not just, a ratio of 6 to 1 or 8 to 1 is just superhuman. I mean, that's rare. It's usually closer to 1 to 1, 2 to 1, and I'm sure there's cases where it can be very high, but you're taking, there's obviously a leniency towards this being very open-ended, and if you created something that was much tighter where there's an absolute limit that's very close to physiological levels, you have a much better scenario for testing.
Well, do we know? So this data to me is showing the 1 in 480 women, and just generally, one of the other things they talk about in Sports Gene was from this testing of Olympic athletes and stuff, that they were generally on the high side of testosterone.
Sure.
Anyways, yeah. They were talking about females. Do you know, or do you think that's the same thing is true for males, that male Olympic athletes are generally higher testosterone levels?
I would have to believe so. I mean,
yeah,
there's, yeah, I mean, I would have to believe, yeah, the higher testosterone males are going to be driven and selected to be in those sports, right? I mean, or in sports.
So if naturally higher testosterone males are being allowed to compete and there's whatever limit on that testosterone being placed, but they tend towards the higher side of things, then women, and when I'm saying that, I mean born as a woman, lived as their whole life as a woman, tend towards the higher side of the testosterone as well. That, to me, makes perfect sense.
Right. Yeah.
What does not is to have a woman transitioning, or a man transitioning into woman.
Yeah.
And to not just have the benefits of higher testosterone with the other physical attributes, height, heart size, lung size, bone density, red blood cell count, hip structure being relatively the same, but now to take all of those advantages and only diminish this one advantage, not eliminate this one advantage, but diminish it to a point that it's still 3 to 20 times higher than the normal range for women, to me seems like these governing bodies in sport are doing female athletes a disservice.
Yeah. Well, that's the interesting case, right? I would say especially in like the transition, the people that are transitioning from male to female, because I don't believe there are women transitioning to men that are succeeding in sport at a high level against men.
That
were men from birth or you know, that didn't transition.
That to me is the simplest argument about the fairness of gender identity, transgender athletes in sport.
Yeah.
All of it is man transitioning to woman and winning and beating everyone and setting all these new records. When someone, and maybe someone has an example of this and they can post it in the comments, when there is one, and we'd really need more than one, but when there is a example of female transitioning to male and being a champion, an international champion in that sport, then I think we can begin to discuss. Oh, well, it doesn't matter if you're a man or a woman. It's all about the hormones, right? Yeah, it's all about the hormone therapy.
Yeah, yeah.
When Jera Lee Vega, you know, this is well known, so it's not like we're talking about secret. If Jera Lee Vega was the American record holder, or is the American record holder in the snatch, clean, jerk, and total in the 63-kilo class?
Just the clean, jerk, and total.
Oh, okay.
Woolfolk has the snatch.
Oh. Clean, jerk, and total, and now has transitioned. I don't know at what stage of the transition. Definitely the hormone therapy part. I can't speak to the surgery part of things. But if she comes along, or he comes along, and starts competing as a male, and sets the American record in the clean, jerk, and the total, then sure, then we can have a discussion that
it's all copacetic.
Yeah, it's all about the hormones, and you just do the hormone therapy, and it's all fine.
Yeah.
Because what is being done now is in an effort of political correctness or sensitivity, oversensitivity, whatever it is, that they're being, in an effort to be fair to an incredibly small minority of female athletes, they are being unfair, potentially, you know, creating a environment that can be unfair to the overwhelming majority of the female athletes.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's also, there's so many really interesting cultural aspects and social aspects to it, too. I mean, this only really affects female competitors.
Yeah.
In that the male competitors, 50% of the field, you know. It's very interesting. I mean, there's a lot to be said for, you know, What are the ramifications of it? I honestly don't believe there's going to be hordes of men changing gender to compete in women. I don't think that's the case. So, you know, assuming that's not the case, does it lend itself to say it would perhaps be more fair to everybody if there was another category for people that have changed gender from one or the other, right, female to male and male to female, to compete against people that have the most similar situation to you would be the most fair. I mean, the irony is that in masters competitions, you don't compete against people of different age groups initially. You compete against everybody in the same age group first. So they're even distinguishing based on age, there needs to be more categories. If they can make the assumption there needs to be distinguished categories for different ages, well, 5 years, wouldn't the same be said for having, you know, a certain amount of time as a different gender to be switched to another? And that, I mean, that's where I feel like it's kind of an interesting, there's so many categories, yet there isn't a category here. And maybe it is just a matter of sport recognizing these people and saying, hey, you deserve to have your own level playing field amongst people that are in the same situation as you, and be recognized as excellent athletes in that position, rather than being put into categories that are not necessarily fair to you know, everybody involved in it, right?
Yeah, you know, I don't remember if I was reading Facebook comments or saw an interview about this with Janae Marie Krosielewski, formerly Matt Krosielewski, talking about having gone on hormone therapy and that kind of stuff, and how his strength levels were affected, and kind of saying, like, you know, I ended up doing about the numbers that these top female powerlifters are doing.
Yeah.
That was, you know, 650 squat, 400 bench, or 600 squat, 400 bench, 650 deadlift, something around there.
Sure.
And powerlifting, untested powerlifting becomes such a further clouded issue because, you know, hormone therapy is not the right term going on.
Self-medication.
Yeah, a lot of self-medication in untested female powerlifting that kind of clouds the issue more. But he was saying, you know, he went from being this top men's lifter to lifting the numbers, you know, not in competition, but lifting the numbers the same as the top female lifter. So is that evidence that, well, it's the same? Like, and it's only a one person example, but
yeah, I feel like that's got to be a stretch because I mean, he maybe, let's say those numbers were the same, that you're talking about somebody who's coming down to that from a super physiological level as a male, you know, and who was a very, very strong male, top, you know, 0.1%, to now be literally the strongest female.
Yeah.
Right? I think that's almost more of like, you know, if he came down and became, you know, top 10% of elite female lifters, maybe that would be a little more kind of buy into like the idea that, okay, maybe they are more equal, because there's got to be women that are very, very predisposed and talented to it and taking drugs.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know.
Well, it's like you said, the example you said before, if you have a female athlete, you know, so we have a male athlete transitioning to female at age 25. So for 25 years lived as a male, regular testosterone levels, you know, everything that comes along with that. And then at age 27 has now passed the IOC standard of 2 years of hormone therapy post-op to compete as a female. People are much more inclined to say that is okay, I think.
Yeah.
Rather than have a female, and this is going to be off because, you know, no one is taking steroids as a baby, but for the sake of this, 25 years of performance enhancing drug use and then cutting that out at age 25 to then compete at age 27 in a situation that they can pass the drug test, let's say, and I know different things, you know, you're supposed to have been clean for 2 years or 3 years or 7 years and you sign your name and whatever and say that you have been. If you pass the test, you pass the test.
Yeah.
So let's say 25 years of drug use, stop for 2 years and compete. Almost no one is going to be like, oh, that's fair.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. I mean, you know, they could theoretically just say, I mean, sport isn't necessarily about being all inclusive. Sport is about qualifying for the standards to compete, whatever, the Olympics and these top level sports. You could almost say that any manipulation of hormones is against the rules. Up, down, whatever,
side
to side, any kind of change of hormones for a medical reason or anything is not allowed. And you're going to isolate, you're going to obviously eliminate a lot of people, people that have medical conditions, all of those things. But, you know, I mean, there's obviously like temporary use exemption forms, which come into play that broad, you know, bring up another big issue when the entire water polo team has asthma and they all have clenbuterol prescriptions and, you know, you have prescription for Adderall, the super, super strong, you know, stimulants. Like, there's so much gray area around all of this just in the world of sports being, you know, generally on the shadier side and all of that. But, you know, it's very interesting. I will say that it's a confusing scenario. It's difficult to explain how it makes sense or how it fits into the realm of being fair when you have to make it as, have to explain it as simply as you can to someone who's maybe, you know, 10 years old. How do you explain the idea that it's,
well, some, to, you know, to that exact situation? I mean, that is a scenario that happened. in New Zealand for you guys.
Yes, they did, yeah.
Your son, Asher, 10 yeah. years old, there yeah. with you. He sees his mom, Joanne, yeah. lift great, make these PRs,
yeah.
and then not win
yeah, yeah.
Grandmaster. What was that conversation?
You know,
what was Joe's reaction to it, even?
I mean, I think everyone was just kind of confused.
And Joanne's about as progressive a Bay Area person.
Yeah, we live in San Francisco. Joanne has no, yeah. there's no issues with the situation. We're just confused. I think the confusion from a lot of people, I think there, was more a matter of, for one is, let's say you're in that situation. You're in, you know,
Laurel Hubbard.
I was Miss Hubbard. I'm not sure. You're in Hubbard's cupboard here, and you're having to say, okay, I'm going to compete because I'm allowed to compete, which is fair. You win. What is the motive? You know, I mean, I suppose if you believe that it's fair and it's right and you're within the rules, it's fine. When you have to step back and say, it's very easy to eat, like, put up an argument saying clearly this is not as fair as it may seem on the surface.
Well, I would be interested to ask Laurel Hubbard, who was competing as a Masters, you know, how old,
yeah.
old she was?
35, I think, 36.
Right. So let's say Laurel Hubbard's 36. Laurel Hubbard, what do you think about a female athlete taking steroids?
Right.
Up until age 34, having taken them for as long of period of time as conceivable. And then stopping for 2 years and passing the test and competing against you as a woman.
Yeah.
Is that
yeah.
fair to,
yeah,
to
I mean,
her? I would be shocked.
Yeah, that's what I think is most interesting,
yeah.
right? Well, or let's say you qualify for the Olympics, go to the Olympics, and you get just murdered by, you know, a Russian woman who has a doping violation at 14 years old by 50 kilos in the total. I mean, how do you feel about that? I mean, it's a very like, oh, I got beat fair and square because they're within the written rules, by the rules as they are stated, not the spirit of the rules here.
I know the
really odd.
The number two seed in Marissa's weight class for IPF Worlds upcoming, Olga Golubeva, a Russian lifter, has served a doping suspension.
Probably tainted meat or something.
Probably the target. Those Moscow targets.
it's got a backwards R in the title. yeah, I mean, that's again, you know, I mean, I think everyone was very confused. You know, I would say it's more confusion as to what's happening here. What are we watching? How does this work? I don't think, you know, there's obviously people that say, oh, it's wrong. I don't necessarily agree that it's wrong. I think it's just there's a confusion as to, I think this is probably something within the realm of sports that is very poorly, the rules are very poorly laid out. They're very kind of almost like off the cuff, like they had to figure it out on the spot and they sort of just went with this. I mean, it used to be, you know, that whatever society and culture were, it was easy to just say, pull your pants down and we'll do that. Yeah. And they kind of just, you know, maybe turned the blind eye to what was going on, or they, you know, they didn't acknowledge people for where, you know, where they believe they should be acknowledged. But now it's a situation where, you know, this has happened. These situations in which there are speculation as to, you know, gender testing scenarios. You have the people that have genetic predispositions to different things. You have people that are transitioning. There needs to be a better understood and established method for, you know, the rules by which they compete, where they compete, how that's fair for all athletes.
Yeah.
Now, I know, like, CrossFit, there was issues a few years ago with an athlete that was trying to compete in CrossFit and was flat out just denied.
Yes.
In which CrossFit is a private business, so they can kind of do whatever they want. But their logic was very straightforward, as I believe, was just, well, you had the advantages of being a male for so long, and you changed, and so that's not fair.
And in that instance, at least, the transition had happened
really long time.
Yeah, 15 years
yeah.
before the CrossFit issue came about.
Yeah.
But, yeah, to me, it and I know the question of what is gender, what is someone's gender in the last 5 years, 10 years, whatever, has become a much, much more complex answer than...
Well, you got Mankini.
than when your mom gave birth to you and the doctor said, congrats, you have a new baby boy. Congrats, you have a new baby girl. The question, the answer to that has become much, much more complex.
Right.
I don't know that the complexity and feelings and nuance of all of those answers should enter into what sport or what division that the people are supposed to be competing in. To me, that's a much more simple line to draw of you are going to compete as the gender that you were born.
Right.
Where it's a more gray area when you get into this androgen insensitivity syndrome, SRY gene, hyperandrogenism of people who have, when they were born, they said, this is a girl, but have the internal testes and high testosterone level that comes along with that. That's a much more complex thing.
Yeah.
Clearly, there should be a limit on testosterone that female competitors can have implemented. Yeah, that is no-brainer. But, you know, for my opinion, competing as the gender that someone was born, there are nuances to that answer now that are beyond my understanding, and that's for someone else to answer, but...
You know, it's funny, if you think about, let's say the rules are just the rules. They're exactly the way they are. You're going to get drug tested randomly at a competition. 15 years ago, Laurel Hubbard would have failed at least two drug tests for having too high a testosterone level. So there's a scenario where you would have already been banned and ineligible to compete anyways because in a, like, the same scenario,
that's a good point.
A female at 14 years old, Kasherina Tatiana, fails drug test. She has a drug test on her name at 14. You know, like... You circumvented the circumvented the rules by being a different gender then, and now it benefits you when you transition, right? I think, it's a very odd place. I mean, because then there's no way you'd pass a drug test. Yeah. I mean, you have a testosterone level that's 10 times what a woman was at the time.
That's a very good point.
Very odd.
Yeah, I think that's one of the easiest analogies or whatever to use is extended time of drug use versus extended time of being a man, and then a 2-year transitional period of off drugs, hormone therapy. One of them, people are much more inclined to protect, much more inclined to say that this is okay. And I get that there's emotion and sympathy and empathy and these incredibly high rates of suicide within transgender people and all this stuff. And that's why people, I think, are wanting to say, yeah, this is okay. Because no one's saying this woman who's been doing steroids, who would have been caught 10 times over, she can compete now because she was clean for 2 years.
Yeah. Yeah, it's
because
really,
there's no feelings and empathy about that.
It's purely would have been a violation of the rules back then. What's interesting too is I think I'm not sure how correct me if I'm wrong, and I'm sure people will, but there I believe in certain sports, maybe certain countries, there's what's called a doping passport, and this is a passport that you essentially have that's stamped, and they keep records of testing when it's done, and they do blood testing where they'll keep track of red blood cell count, testosterone levels, and these things. And they keep track of this data throughout the course of the athlete's career. This may be a German thing, where they keep track of these things, and if they see, like, okay, it's usually for red blood cell, like EPO and stuff, where, oh, hey, we have a baseline for 5 years here. Now suddenly your red blood cell count is twice as high. What's going on? Because you have to have, you can't compare. You don't know exactly where that is, right?
Yeah.
But if you have somebody who would, again, the same situation, had a doping passport, had 5 years of, extremely high testosterone levels for a female, then all of a sudden they drop and now you're a female and you're competing, there's the statistical analysis that's not going to, you know, it's going to show that you would have been guilty of doping violation then. Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, at end of the day, it's a big question. It's a tough question. It's one that neither Max or I have the answer to, but certainly we have our opinions about it. You know, it hit close to home.
Yeah.
The situation with Joe and competing against Laurel Hubbard in New Zealand, and it's a conversation that needs to be had because, in my opinion, these governing bodies of sport, in an effort to be fair to the minority, are being unfair to the majority of their competitors. It's going to be something that over the next several years, I'm sure, is going to hit close to home again. You know, whether it's Ada v. Hubbard, you know, round two, or it starts coming into effect USAW, IPF powerlifting, you know, this different stuff. It's gonna be something we have to deal with, and it's gonna be something that there have to be questions about.
Sure.
So, you know, hopefully we brought up some good points. Like I said, I tried to do a good little bit of research on this and have some useful numbers and useful case studies and stuff to bring to the table with this. We're interested to hear your feedback, so please, you know, if we mess things up, if we said the wrong term, if we got some of the rules wrong, let us know in the comments. Please try and keep the discussion, you know, respectful and respectful because it is something that's very sensitive to people, but a conversation that needs to be had. So with that, I think we kind of end that discussion. Max, where can they find you?
You can find me on Instagram and Facebook, Max_Ada, or you can email me max@jtsstrength for any questions about online coaching or the Juggernaut team.
And I'm Chad Wesley Smith @ChadWesleySmith and @JuggernautTraining on Facebook and Instagram, filling up your news feed all day. Make sure to subscribe to the Juggernaut YouTube channel with the best fitness videos on all of YouTube. And if you enjoyed the podcast, please go on iTunes, leave us a 5-star review, write us something funny, and we always appreciate seeing those. Till the next time.